Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by Infutor Data Solutions. Infutor connects companies with their customers by delivering real-time identities, attributes, and actionable intelligence from its identity graph of 266 million U.S. consumers. Keep listening to hear Zora Sennett, Infutor's SVP of Marketing and Partnerships, talk us through industry trends and how to better unlock the value of first-party data.
Hey there, it's Allison Schiff, and this is Ad Exchanger Talks. This week, we've got Ross McCray on the podcast, the very energetic CEO and founder of VideoAmp, which is the audience measurement company that's, well, choose your imagery. It's angling for a slice of Nielsen's market share. It's looking to wear the measurement crown. It's aiming to knock Nielsen off its legacy perch. Advertisers and broadcasters need to meet the challenges posed by changes in the way people consume media and content. And VideoAmp, founded not that long ago in 2014, wants to be the company that helps them do that. In Ross's view, it's time for a new currency. But what does it actually mean to take on a titan like Nielsen? Let's find out. Ross, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start out by looking to the past for a little bit, because you left UCLA to be an entrepreneur, which you are, so you did it. But you studied astrophysics while you were there, that usually would be like a fun fact that I would start out the podcast with, be like, hey, fun fact, guys. But you can learn that about you just from looking at your LinkedIn page. So I want something else. Like, I want something about Ross McCray that might surprise people.
Sure. What about VideoAmp being my 43rd business? How's that?
How is there enough time in the like years you've lived on Earth to have done that?
Yeah, there unfortunately is. You know, I was always trying things, and you know, I get frustrated by problems really easily, and my natural response is I got to solve this. And so over the years, I just kept getting frustrated by things and kept trying to solve things. I mean, and needed to make money a lot. I was on my own and didn't really have any way to make money. So try to figure it out as we went by. And here we are, 43 companies later.
I mean, I need a few examples of some of these companies.
Okay. Let's see. We did, I did Christmas lights installation. I made a product from China, put it in the Home Depot and Lowe's for weatherproofing, electrical outdoor. I did an email mobile app. I had an environmental business, an events company, a party bus rental business, a hosing business, a trucking business, Airbnb arbitrage, parking lot business. I made a pan.
You made a pan? Pan?
Yeah. With a cookie pan with like, you can put like your spoon rest like in the handle. That one sucked. Yeah. I made a thing called a beach caddy, which was like a bag you can take to the beach with like all your shit in it. So yeah, I mean, I can go on and on. We had a lot of stuff that I tried, and some were just completely catastrophically failures that like I went to market and everyone's like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. No one cares about this. Others had some legs, but just weren't big enough. So just kept trying to find the right one.
I babysat for our next door neighbor's kids when I was in high school. That was pretty much my only brush with entrepreneurship. So hats off. So I read an article about you. I was doing a little research for our recording. It was a November 2017 article from Inc. And it makes this passing reference to the fact that you don't really watch a lot of TV, which I thought was kind of interesting considering VideoAmp measures TV audiences. And I know also all audiences, digital audiences, yeah. But do you like watch anything these days? I mean, it is the golden age of content. So just curious.
Yeah, no, I can't stand it. I can't sit still. There's just no way. It's like the worst thing ever to just sit down and just do nothing and veg on a personal level. But But I understand that people love doing that, and that drives happiness and entertainment for them. So I'm very inspired by our mission to be able to support that golden age of TV. And part of the reason why we started the company was to enable that everyone in the world could have access to that. And we saw stats that a high majority of people can't pay for subscription streaming or any of those extra fees. So we wanted to support the advertising ecosystem where that buyers, advertisers and media owners and consumers can all have a healthy three-way value exchange. So people that do enjoy that can have access to the content at scale on a global level. So even though I don't like personally do it, I kind of like, you know, solving problems, being out there, being active, working out. I want to make sure that we can increase happiness for people. And that's a key way.
So you wouldn't watch something while on a Peloton, for example? Or is that a time for like Zoom meetings?
Yeah, well, I've had my fair share of working out and taking meetings, but, not really. I work out with the team a lot. So usually when I'm working out, it's with clients or a colleague. So we're usually working out and shit-talking each other and pushing each other and lots of yelling and screaming.
I'm not sure we can do business because... My resolution is to exercise more, but kudos. So let's talk a little bit about VideoAmp's technology and approach. So sure. I want you to explain it to me twice. So once I want you to, just in a couple of sentences, explain VideoAmp's technology to like the proverbial grandmother out in the world, mm-hmm. and then you can describe VideoAmp's technology and approach as if you were talking to somebody in the industry.
Sure. So I guess for the grandmother here,
the grandmothers who listen to Ad Exchange Talks.
yeah, of course. Yeah. Look, we tell advertisers, where their money is gone, what's working and what they can do next to drive more sales. And for media sellers who are selling advertising, we give them measurement to help them optimize and increase the value of their programming so that it drives more sales for their advertisers.
That makes sense. I mean, that might actually be a good explanation just for anybody.
Yeah, but... I don't really know if I have more than for the other, for the ad exchanger people. No, but we can't.
So what do you make of this moment in time, like the rise of alternative currencies? Like what's in the water right now? Because it's not like broadcasters and advertisers haven't been pushing, mm-hmm. they haven't been pushing Nielsen to move faster and like do more for years, and there hasn't been this need. I mean, there's the pandemic, obviously, and the inability to service people meters and that, you know, all of that. But that feels more like a straw that broke the camel's back sort of situation, as opposed to like a, you know, what was brewing.
I think so. And I think this one's worth a few minute context to, you know, how we started and where we got here. So we started the company in June 1st of 2014, so about 7.5 years ago. And we started the company because of what, ironically, you said earlier regarding the golden age of content. So we saw that the bet was consumers wanted to watch content whenever they want, wherever they want, and how they want. And that with people getting more and more digital devices, the phones, the iPads, you know, smart TVs arising, video on demand services like YouTube, which was obviously one of the first ones, and now you have so much more with streaming, that was going to be way better for the consumer, and that's how it was going to go. And since it was so much better, that there's going to be the ability for more and more advertisers to connect with these consumers because they're watching more and more content, and the more content they watch, the more advertising, the more content, you can invest in making more content. So it's this feedback loop. So the vision was, it's going away from a traditional living room first, traditional TV, linear TV, where you got to be there at 3 p.m. or 5 p.m. to watch your favorite show, and it's going to go into a different way of fragmentation. And our thesis was measurement, third-party auditor to let buyers and sellers know that their services have been rendered, meaning I'll give you $1 million for so-and-so many people seeing my ad. That was required, right? That's the fundamental building block for the ability for advertising to work. You always need a third-party person to be agnostic, tell you kind of what's happening. and that we created a measurement company in order to be in a world where it was digital fragmentation, convergence between traditional TV and modern day digital. And so that's how we started the company. And so for the last, you know, it took the first 2 years to build the product. In the last 5 years, we've been selling measurement, not currency, to advertisers primarily, as well as some media sellers, whereas they would log in to see what's working, bringing it to sales, so attribution, looking at deduplicated reach and frequency, so going beyond the silos and looking at overlap with the same person that saw my ad on TV versus streaming, or the same person that saw my ad over here on YouTube, the same person over here, right? So giving them that unified view. And then what has been happening, now to kind of get to your question, over the last year or two, maybe we start the pandemic, streaming certainly accelerated during the pandemic. And there's lots of stats out there that said this was a trend that's already going, but now people are looking for more content to watch or at home, especially in the beginning of the pandemic. People are looking to try these new streaming apps to see what else is on there. And so the velocity that went to streaming continued to accelerate. And what happened here is that the way that currency is done is not really meant for a streaming world. And so the more viewership that goes to streaming, the more strain it puts on the system. And media owners and advertisers haven't felt that the legacy way of measuring streaming and cross-platform could be done in a more legacy system that are primarily reliant on a panel that was built for a traditional TV home only. So I think to your point of the last straw, the more that these media companies are investing heavily in the streaming, everyone's building a streaming service, everyone is producing content, and they feel like that it's not being properly measured or valued, let alone how people can connect all of these things. So as I'm buying TV and streaming and packages now in the upfront, how do I look at this together versus it, and the overlap? I think these are all the reasons that was already happening. And we were doing currency pilots in the beginning of the year with some people. And then I think the recent news of legacy measurement systems and the panels and unable to service that through the pandemic and some companies being no longer MRC accredited just really accelerated this, but it was already happening.
Well, what is your partnership with Viacom CBS, for example, and then also your partnership with Hyphametrics, you know, the alt panel company, and I believe you're doing a pilot, or you joined a pilot that the ANA is putting together for finding privacy compliant cross media solutions for the industry. So those partnerships, deals like that, joining pilots of that nature, what does that just like portend for like the audience measurement game in light of what you were just saying about everything, changing and so much strain on the current system?
Yeah. So all of it is really related to just furthering the adoption of our measurement solution. So the Viacom CBS, we can start there. The Viacom CBS solution is them publicly acknowledging that they have access to our measurement and that they intend to use our measurement for media as a currency. And how I understand that is they are going to advertisers and saying, we can guarantee and contract and do pricing based off of your numbers versus some other company's numbers. And so they're looking at a way to use that beyond optimization to sales or attribution, as we've been historically used for, and wanting to do guarantees on our data set. And because we have a lot of agency holding companies and advertisers already using our measurement, that there's a large pool of people that they're contacting who are already used to our numbers, who are saying, if you're already using it for optimization or for attribution, then can we use this for currency too? And so they're saying they're open for business and they're ready to do that. And I think that that they believe a more digital first measurement like our solutions, you know, we integrate directly into their log level systems. We do it all in a privacy way, which is actually sort of what the ANA's pilot is trying to do, you know, current broad-based privacy systems that allow you to read log level data, but in a full privacy compliant manner without ever re-identifying the consumer. And so going to a more big data first approach versus panel first approach, that is something that we have been doing. And the partnership with Hyphametrics and others like T-Vision that we have is more of a leveraging their data sets as a calibration panel to our big data first approach. And they get things like co-viewing. So when we're integrating into smart TV manufacturers like Vizio or other set-top box providers on the MVPD side, or we're getting log-level data directly from streaming apps or other platforms, the TV data we get is usually at a household level. And because that's how, you know, we're reading it from the device. So this device saw this ad, and licensing alternative panel providers like the ones that we mentioned allow us to go to the number of people in the household. So that's a way for us to go from household to person, and we can use that to ensure there's no flaws in our overall big data approach as well, and to help correct and calibrate for that if we see any gaps.
So I want to go a little deeper on the quality question, because, you know, big data obviously brings scale, and, you know, it's really important, you know, in light of how consumption habits are changing. But how do you ensure quality? How do you make sure that it's really, you know, accurate and clean?
Yeah. So there are biases in all different types of data sets. And for us, when we're integrating with a log level delivery of these services like streaming, for example, we have to make sure that the data that we're getting in is consistently sending us the data. So checking if there's no outages in the system, able to connect that with other third party data sets and ensuring that there's healthy match rates there, and that all the probabilistic structures in terms of things like opt out rates. So if someone has opted out for someone not wanting to use their data for measurement purposes is being reflected in the sense of, well, there was a million people from the logs, but maybe only 900,000 people we can get the, you know, more information on. So how do you represent that remaining 100,000 people that have opted out? Stuff like that is really why we have a large data science and engineering organization. And it's interesting time regarding the debate of big data and panels because of all of this. And, you know, there are some people that believe that you need big data and panel calibration to correct for that. So going big data first, like getting access to logs, then using panels to calibrate it. And we have a lot of others, people that believe it's actually worse to do that because the panels itself are, you know, more necessary, you know, could be more skewed than the big data itself. And we've seen people reference opt-out rates, like the amount of people that are recruited for a panel may not be fundamental.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. Like who are doing that as well as the opt-out rate, people that are starting, you know, people that do get panels, it's like a high majority of them end up opting out. And, you know, it's not, continuous. Whereas on the big data side, broadly as the industry, it's a 99% representation, meaning there's only like less than 1% people that are opting out, you know, believe it or not. So some people say you don't want to calibrate using the panels because it makes it more inaccurate. So it becomes a philosophical statistical debate, and for us, we have both, and currency and measurement is about what the industry thinks is truth as closely as possible. And I think over time there'll be more and more data for people to come in here and to debate on it. But our position is we have to try all avenues and continue to try our paths towards finding the most accurate solution. At the end of the day, what buyers and sellers, and most importantly, ensuring that consumer privacy is protected and steward, I think we'll see a lot of change.
It is an interesting point in time when, you know, something like this becomes a little bit of a philosophical debate, you know, while all of it is, you know, being decided and evened out, because, you know, it is a time of change, and that's always sort of fun. I think it probably really appeals to you when, you know, things get a little bit tricky, because then it's time to, you know, pop up with elegant, compliant solutions. I mean, if everything was easy, then I think you'd be bored, Ross.
Yeah, for sure be bored. But also that's where value is created, and where there's a lot of confusion and there's a lot of change going on and winners and losers emerging. I think it's part of the reason why the financial industry has been so excited about the space. You know, when we started the company, people hated the space. I would go and pitch our solutions about the future, and, you know, you'd have VCs and people saying, oh, ad tech, like, how'd you get this meeting? Get out of here. Oh, shit. Right. And then over the last year or two, man, it's been completely shifted. I mean, I've had some of these largest hedge funds in the world be like, this is our top priority, because they, you know, they ride macro trends, right? They believe in the consumer shift now. Streaming is clearly a household topic and everyone's speaking about it, and that's got their attention. privacy is changing massively, right? Where just everything from Apple to the IDFAs, to cookies going away, to all of these trends, and people need to get more and more serious about, which is great. You know, that's clearly breaking a lot of companies that have been built on legacy approaches. And so they see a lot of winners and losers coming out of that. And so you follow these trends, and you follow the trends of brands wanting to get better measurement and have things more accountable, optimizable. Here we are. So it's very exciting times for disruptors. And we're definitely past the point of early adopters. Like, this is maybe something that is, you know, working and getting into that next part of the scale where I think it's really have tipped over and the gravity has shifted.
So we're going to take just a really quick sponsor break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the future a little bit. VideoAmp just raised a new round, $275 million Series F with this huge valuation. So we'll talk a little bit about that and some of your ambitions for what's to come.
I'm Sarah Sluice, executive editor at AdExchanger, and I'm here talking with Zora Sennett, SVP of Marketing and Partnerships with our sponsor, Infutor Data Solutions. Hi, Zora.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me. And thank you for hosting the podcast. My colleagues and I have been big fans from the beginning.
Thank you so much, Zora. Can you help our listeners understand what the identity resolution landscape looks like right now?
Sure. So as you know, it was a challenge pre-pandemic for companies to effectively unlock the value of their first-party data, but COVID has certainly accelerated that trend and compounded all of the problems that identity providers have been operating against for years. Changes in consumer locations, their identifiers, their purchase patterns, and there are more connected devices now than ever before. And that means that advancements in new media and updates to operating systems will make targeting across those devices a challenge. And beyond that, people are just living their lives, changing jobs, having kids, developing new interests. That's a lot of a variability to manage at scale while maintaining a level of comfort around the accuracy of your consumer profiles. So you can see how challenging it is for the marketer to keep up with those changes. From Infutor's perspective, we've been tackling this problem for nearly two decades, which doesn't mean we are perfect at a perfect fit for solving any sort of identity problem out there, but it does mean that we have a level of expertise that allows us to leverage this velocity of change as an accelerant for our business our product strategy.
So Infutor's approach is being agnostic to identifiers and also agnostic to brands, publishers, and platforms. How do you manage this variety of clients?
Great question. In terms of use cases, brands typically work with us direct or through one of our clean room partners or platforms to build and enrich their first party data. So there it's all about understanding a brand's appetite for data, where it's most impactful, and then routing those insights to the right place at the right time. On the publisher side, the goal is all about extending reach and adding additional identifiers to help improve onboarding and performance for advertisers. And platforms incorporate our data in-app to improve their own consumer identity offering. So we've built a lot of flavors of identity resolution services, but what makes it simple to service the brands, the publishers, and the platforms is that those services are all anchored to one thing: our identity graph, which we view as the most complete and accurate picture of adult individuals and households in the US. And we've layered on flexibility in the form of delivery as well. So a lot of our services and data sets are available to test in platforms like Snowflake and Amazon's Data Exchange On Demand today. These can inform custom models, analytics, audience segments, you name it.
Thank you, Zora. Where can our listeners go to learn more about Infutor?
Well, you can check us out at infutor.com/AdExchanger. That would be I-N-F-U-T-O-R, infutor.com/AdExchanger. Thanks again, Sarah.
Thank you, Zora.
Okay, and we're back. So before the break, I just teased, the new valuation, the $1.4 billion valuation based on the $275 million Series F that you guys just raised. So I'm curious, how far into the alphabet of series is VideoAmp planning to go? And then also why you guys decided to raise again now? I mean, I kind of know the answer. The opportunity is like very hot, but, you know, just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I never thought we'd be at F, that's for sure. I can tell you that, you know, so my predictions are clearly bad. But why we decided to raise again, you know, the truth is we weren't. We weren't at all. We were really focused, and we have enough cash even before this to go on. And we have just been grinding and building. I mean, we're very fortunate. The company has been growing at an average of 100% year over year since we started over the last, you know, five and a half years since we've been in market. And the company's doing well, and we're hiring a lot, and we're driving it. And most of our revenue, as I sort of alluded to a little bit in the beginning, was more so on the measurement side, on the advertisers and agencies. But what's happened with this push towards all these trends and the industry asking people to become alternative currencies, you know, there's a lot of like RFPs going out there from the networks, and everyone's sort of coming together, and the industry is just deciding that this is the thing they want to talk about. It kind of reminds me like programmatic in 2012 or 13. Now it's alternative currencies, and it's everyone's major focus. So given that we have already been in a leadership position in terms of, you know, alternative measurement and attribution and living in a big data first approach, which is basically the blueprint where everyone's asking for currency, we clearly said, all right, sure, we'll raise our hand and we'll move forward. It's always been the plan, but this has really accelerated it. And we got a lot of inbounds. I mean, we had just all of this stuff going around. We had like 15 or 20 different investors that are really top tier come out and email us, and would come to conferences that I was speaking to and follow it up. And we thought, well, maybe next year, 2022, we can think about raising, but let's get through this year. We're having a great year, and maybe if it makes sense. And then we had a bunch of firms come in and said, well, you know, screw your plans. What if I, gave you this and this and this, and started putting pieces of paper down. And we had a couple different firms just basically completely preempt the process. And it's crazy, you know, like no major governance, no board seats, no this, no that, just giving us sort of whatever we needed to, because they thought we were going to win or be one of the winners in the space. So given it was very, you know, minimal dilution, and the other terms were phenomenal, and the partners were just world class. We were very fortunate to have companies like Spruce House and D1 and Tiger Global behind us now, and, you know, to the repertoire and the reputation that they have and the other portfolio companies, we said it sort of was a no-brainer, and this can take our three-year plan that we had and accelerate it into one, hiring hundreds and hundreds of people. And we do think this is a generational shift, and if the market is coming to us and others asking for this right now, then we want to respond. We don't need to wait for it. And historically, we've been known to be aggressive and wanting to swing for it and go for it. We're not looking for, you know, an early exit. We've been approached for acquisitions many times over the years, and clearly we've said no. So for us, we really want to solve this mission. We want to be a long-term, 100-year-old company that can be a cornerstone of measurement that powers this ecosystem. And for us, this fundraise allows us to accelerate those plans exponentially. And I think that the amount that we can do in this next year will be able to create a lot of value and to deliver on the timelines that everyone is asking for. So we ended up saying, all right, well, fuck it, let's go.
So you want to be the company that in 100 years, you know, there is an upstart. I'm not calling you an upstart. I mean, you're a very solid company, but you'll be the Nielsen in 100 years and someone can come and knock you off your perch, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, that gets me fired up thinking about that. I mean, I love healthy competition. I love the free market, and, you know, let the best company win. So it's amazing.
Well, so I mean, the ambition is really cool, and like now is the right, you know, really the right time, and it's fun that people are throwing money at you. But like, what does it actually entail? You know, when your ambition is to take a market share away from a market leader, I mean, yes, there's a lot of frustration in the industry, like we were talking about, and broadcasters and advertisers are looking for alternatives. They're already, you know, signing up alternatives, working with you. But this is also, it is Nielsen's opportunity to lose, even though they've been shaken. So what does it actually take to put, you know, all of that sort of like vim and vigor into action? You know, I mean, obviously you have lots of technology in the market, but I mean, now that you're, you know, sort of super funded, what it means.
Yeah. So for us, it's, I think the industry is changing so much where it's anyone's to take, you know. I think people think about currency and they think of legacy currency companies and some that have very large market shares out there and, you know, known as sort of being the one stop for that. But it's just the fragmentation. There hasn't been a currency that's existed for this cross-platform, multiple publishers, digital plus linear, you know, world, right? That hasn't existed. That hasn't. So as you know, a part of me says, well, sure, there's maybe a market shift, but it's really it's an entirely new category emerging. And that I think it's anyone's to take and anyone's claim to get after it versus like going after a legacy product or market share. And I think that nuance is important. And so for us, the fact that it's not, you know, the gravity, as I said earlier, shifted to asking for this versus us pitching it and educating. You know, it used to be also, what's the value of alternative measurement and why should I pay for this and how does it help my advertiser or how does it help the media owner? That whole process has been skipped, right? And now it's like, here are the questions I have. Can you do these 19 things and how fast can you get it done? So it's gone, it's shifted into extremely tactical and throughput oriented. And so with this funding, it helps us hire and get there faster. But honestly, the first thing that we did, and we still do, is try to inspire our people who are the ones who are delivering on these technical solutions, primarily the engineering and product and data science teams who need to develop all of these capabilities and to continue to take what we have now and to do all the extra, you know, the last mile things here. And every single person in this company is an equity holder. Everyone has the financial upside, and most people here that come to the company inherently culturally want to be a disruptor and want to go for it big. And, you know, we have a lot of people that think and feel similarly. So you have a certain kind of DNA, a person here that's mission oriented, that wants to find a better way to measure, that wants to build a legacy that does last 100 years, that are very competitive, et cetera. And then you overlay everyone that has equity, including the most junior people all the way up of all time. And we outsize give equity. So now you're taking a situation that has a very large market that can be, you know, a hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of value creation that the ecosystem can create with these shifts. And people look at what that can mean for them financially and for their families or whatever their goals are. And it really gets people fired up. So for us, it's a lot of long hours, very long hours, weekends, nights. And not because we're asking people to do it, but because they want to do it. They're setting their own goals, they're communicating with the customers, they're hitting stretch goals, they're trying to do that 3 years of work in 1 year, and they're very inspired, and they do believe it's an opportunity for upstarts for us to drive. So it's gone into extremely tactical thinking. There's 119 things we got to get done, and how much can we bridge this down, optimizing on a person level, and you know, trying to get more and be smarter and work harder all at the same time to drive this. And that's really what our culture is feeling right now. And everyone's inspired and feels like, you know, it's worth to put in a couple years of work here if that could potentially give myself and my family the freedom of, you know, 50 years of that financial upside. So people are taking those bets and are going after it. And, you know, our company valuation has grown over 220 times in the last 6 years. So people believe.
So I know you don't really entertain the idea of selling VideoAmp, but do you see like an AMP stock ticker at any point in the nearest future? I mean, it's probably not something to do right now because you have 119 things on your to-do list product wise. But yeah. I mean, it's like you were saying, you used to go meet with like VCs and they'd be like, how the heck you get this meeting, ad tech guy, and boot you out. And now, yeah, you know, VCs and Wall Street are like loving it. So,
yeah, you know, look, anything can happen. So we're absolutely focusing on execution and on delivering of this. And, you know, we're not
for sale. So we're very excited to go and build this value. And I do think longer term, with our ambitions and with our growth and with the potential, we're long-term independent. You know, there's not, there's being a measurement and currency and optimization based company, you have to be independent. So just if you think about it structurally, you know, long-term being a company that can be independent and viable is where we have to be. And so that could be long-term private, it could be long-term public, but either way, our focus is creating optionality and investing, and we'll do the best, you know, structure corporately that helps us achieve the mission, but nothing's off the table.
And I don't know if there already is a company whose stock ticker is AMP, but that should really be your stock ticker, I think. Okay,
I think someone does have it. I think it might.
Oh, do they? It's too bad. Yeah, that would be a good one.
But I appreciate it. Maybe you can give me some other suggestions.
I'll think of something. Let me know when you're going public. Give me the heads up, and I'll come up with a ticker for you. So I don't know if this is an insane question, but is there any world, any universe, any timeline in which VideoAmp ever partners with Nielsen in any way? I mean, or is that just, that doesn't make any sense?
Maybe, you know, maybe. I think this industry is already used to frenemies, and you never know. I think historically they haven't been, you know, I think they've trying to bring everything and create a verticalized solution and go end-to-end, but, you know, maybe they change their minds. But I don't know. I think for us, there's going to be a lot of things emerging. Currency is going to be different. There's going to be a lot of different ingredients and a lot of different parts and a lot of different companies having certain things. And there's been a lot of people asking for more partnership in ways. So we're very open to deliver the best value for anyone, but I would say probability, just from what the industry has seen from certain companies and things, I wouldn't bet on it.
Right. It would be like the lion laying down with the lamb or whatever. I don't know. I can't really quote
sure, maybe.
Because
yeah, but yeah, neither can I. Don't ask me. But I do think, you know, VideoAmp is already working with some competitors in some sense and parts of our business and partnering other ways. So, you know, at least from our perspective, I do fundamentally believe that a healthier ecosystem that's more mature can create more value for the ecosystem and for the companies that are in that position. Meaning, as just to maybe make it plainly, if us and 5 or 6, 7 others can get to where the industry wants to be in 5 years and 2.5 years, let's say, and that it can continue to be more efficient and can get there faster and there's alternatives, then more and more advertisers will be smarter in their investment, right? More return on ad spend, more money, you know, entering the ecosystem because it's working. Their advertising is connecting better with their prospects. Then the media owners are able to then create more revenue. They're getting better value for their inventory. They're doing all the things that they believe that they're, you know, is hurting their business. So they're creating a lot of new value capture, more content's created, more consumers are watching good content. So as this three-way value exchange happens, then there's going to be a more liquidity and more value created. And the more value created by these companies usually follows that in company valuation and revenue models and long-term sustainability. So in other words, I do believe that if this ecosystem can get to this next phase faster, it is better for everyone. So long way of saying, VideoAmp has been very open to partnering in certain places with other people to help the ecosystem get there, because I do believe fundamentally that a 1+1 can equals 3 in this space. And we're focusing on trying to get the ecosystem there.
So can we take a step back for a second, actually? I feel like I should have asked you this earlier, but what got you into audience measurement in the first place? Because it's something you're obviously really passionate about. And there were all of these other, you know, companies, some of them, like you were a kid and you were just trying this and that. But what about like making software for measuring audiences and media and ad performance across platforms was like the meatiest problem for you? Like, how did that actually get on your radar?
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe two things. First is personally, I'm a measurement optimization freak. I'm like, can't
everything I do needs to be optimized and measured, from my time to my sleep to what I eat to, you know, my physical performance to sports to my time management to work, how I'm measuring the right goals. I just have always been that way. I've been very competitive in playing high level sports in the past and other activities that I've just always used measurement and optimization as a key edge to my life. And so I've sort of been that way personally for a very long time. And in the company before VideoAmp, I was doing some things with the YouTube space at the time early on, 2012, 13, et cetera. And a lot of the clients there was asking me, hey, how much money should I put into YouTube versus, you know, Facebook and TV and all this. And the advertisers were just confused. And so I kept hearing that over and over again. So I dug into the space of measurement, and I saw a lot of companies claiming that they solved cross-platform measurement, cross-channel measurement. So I was just so confused, right? It's like, why is everyone asking me about how do you, you know, measure things better? And once I learned about legacy panels and systems and panels measuring digital data, where there was census data available, the truth data available, I was just so confused of how this could be the way it was happening. I didn't believe it. And so after I actually dug into it enough, I was so personally offended. It's like, there's just no way. This is the worst. And so I was pretty fired up. So I said, screw it. Like, this seems to be a very large problem. I can see how this is going to get way worse as fragmentation continues and an inefficient marketplace here will put the whole thing at risk, as we discussed a few times in the three-way value exchange. And after I had some large customers kept asking me about it, I dug in, and the 10 companies that said they solved the problem, after I dug in two or three levels, you know, deeper technically, I realized they're all lying. It's like, oh wow, really don't actually do any of this. So it's a high demand, artificially high supply. So if I started a company that was laser focused on building cross-platform measurement, that and we were focused on that, and we did, you know, engineering first solutions, that we can create a lot of value. So I dove right in, and you know, here we are.
Yeah, it was like audience measurement was your destiny. I feel like. Found it.
Yeah. You know, trust me, I don't think I would have thought that 10 years ago, but it's been so much fun, and it's such a large problem and such a huge opportunity, and it touches everything. And I'm, you know, in love with it and very motivated to work hard and smart to be able to solve this problem. And we have a great team that has, felt the same way.
I mean, you know, seven, eight years ago, I didn't think I'd be hosting a podcast about ad tech. So, you know, and I really enjoy it. So you never know where life will take you.
Yeah.
So last question. It's kind of a silly question, but I feel like you'll have fun with it. So let's say you had a time machine, like a specialized time machine, so you could travel back to any point in your life, but not back to like the Roman Empire or Haight-Ashbury in the 60s or anything like that, like just your own life. So you could meet a younger version of yourself. And putting aside the fact that in time travel law, you're really not supposed to mess with anything or talk to anybody in the past, because then you'll screw with the future. But let's say you could just approach a past version of yourself and give them just like one pearl of wisdom, like a piece of advice. What age would you be? Like, what version of Ross would you be? And like, what would you tell that younger version of yourself?
Oh, damn, that's a good one. I mean, you know, my natural, I mean, how many mistakes have I made? Holy shit. So I don't even know where to begin. It's like, but you know, but part of the beauty is, you know, learning out the hard way. I mean, I think my whole life is learning it the hard way. So part of my identity, if you will. So it's like, on one hand, I'm like, man, you know, get your act together earlier, stop, you know, I mean, how many things I've wasted my time on doing. But you know, I would say, look, I think the time management piece, if I really have to think about when I started to become less of a piece of shit, was when I started to really measure my time effectively. So maybe if I go backwards, I mean, I was like 19 or 18 when I figured it out, or maybe if I was younger, it'd be better. And the thing that I realized was really changed, there's a lot of things that happened, but if I had to pick one, I used to be very, I want this, I want that, I really want, you know, whatever company I was working on and whatever goals that I had, I set all of these things out. And then I said, well, let's think about how I'm spending my time. I don't know how I came across this idea. I started writing down my time, how many hours I slept, what I did when I woke up. Okay, I did this, and then you know, I would go eat food, and then I would go to school, and then I would go hang with friends for an hour or two, and I would do some homework, and I'd play some video games, or when I was older, you know, go out, whatever it was, and I added it all up, and it's like I'm spending like 2 hours on my goals here. I'm like spending time eating, and I'm spending time, you know, I'm sleeping 8 hours a day. And I'm going out, or I'm playing games, or any of this, right? Like, what am I doing? How does this make any sense? So, I just started cutting out all the crap and started being extremely focused. And that was one of the reasons why I dropped out of school, because it was a complete waste of time, nothing towards my goals. So I didn't want to have school get in the way of my education. So I just cut that, and I cut playing out all this other crap. I stopped just doing nothing with friends. I stopped taking 1 hour lunches or an hour and a half dinners. Stopped all that shit. And I started grinding, and I started optimizing every time. I optimized my sleep. I did a lot of sleep hacks, so I put down my sleep a lot. I did a lot of exercise to help get my energy levels up. And so I started optimizing on my time, and then I just felt like I went from having 2 hours to 18 hours a day hyper-focused on my goals, and then my 18 hours were even better than my 2 hours, because I just felt like I was sharper and stronger. And so when I started to optimize my time, be objective of how much time I spend doing everything, that was when I started churning through these problems, and that was the change. So, you know, I mean, if I can do anything, I'd say stutter earlier, but in the end, I don't regret anything. All the dumb mistakes, dumb ideas, things that I've done, I love those mistakes. I love learning from it. I'm a, you know, trial by doing kind of guy. And so I don't regret any of the dumb shit I did. I just looking forward to learning from that and optimizing it and growing. So in the end, I'm very happy with everything.
I mean, it basically is a form of mindfulness, writing everything down and, you know, just kind of checking yourself, because otherwise, you know, it's not clear to yourself what you're doing with your own time. But I have a question. I mean, do you still have any of those pans with the spoons? Because that doesn't sound like a failed idea. Like, I would buy it.
Oh my God. I don't know. You know what's crazy about this? It's like I've only shown this to a few people and everyone loves it. And I was like 15 years old. I'll show you some photos. It's a joke. But apparently this exists now. Like someone trolled me so hard, or someone sent me a pan like last year for the holidays, and it was like my idea that I showed these people. So I will send it to you. But there's no shortage of comedy in my past, that's for sure.
Well, Ross, thank you. You could have been the baking pan king, but instead you started Video Amp. And thank you for sharing your story.
It was so good. Thanks for having me.
As stated earlier in our episode, Infutor Data Solutions, our sponsor, connects companies with their customers by delivering real-time identities, attributes, and actionable intelligence from its identity graph of 266 million U.S. consumers. Visit infutor.com/adexchanger, that's infutor.com/adexchanger, to see all the different ways you can unlock new value from your first-party data.